Today's program is brought to you by Thurman Maple Days. Celebrate flowing of sap in the Adirondacks, self-guiding to seven sites for talks, tours, tastes, and old-fashioned friendliness. For more information, visit ThurmanMapleDays.com.
Hi, this is Katie Kiefer from What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to The Main Course without Patrick Martins on heritageradionetwork.org. I am your host, Alexis McLaughlin, here as always with the affable and the handsome Philip Gilmore.
Oh, thank you. So nice of you to say that.
Oh, I thought I'd give you a friendly open.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you doing?
Daylight savings?
That happened.
Yeah.
I was unaware.
I was actually falling asleep and I thought I had like some, you know, like I saw the clock and I was like, oh, it's, you know, 1:45, and I look, it was, yeah, I thought like I'd stepped into a time warp.
I thought it was going to happen tonight.
Yeah.
Which is why I was totally unprepared.
It's Sunday. Sunday at 2 a.m., which is this morning.
That makes sense.
Yes.
I wasn't really. I dropped the ball. It's fine. Mm-hmm. I was out all day yesterday, so I was in bed well before the time change.
Yeah.
Friend's birthday party, so like a whole day of festivities were planned. Mm-hmm. Went on the Staten Island
Ferry. By festivities, you mean drinking?
Yeah, a lot of drinking. I'm hungover today. Oh. I have two drinks in front of me.
Oh, yeah.
Plus a water. I have like canned coffee,
Is that Japanese coffee, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
UCC coffee?
Yeah. I don't know what that is. It just looked appealing.
Mm-hmm.
It was bright colored and caffeinated. It'll help us all through.
Yes.
Also helping us through today, very excited to have Leighton Edmondson with us in studio.
Yeah, welcome, Leighton.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Yeah.
About to be afternoon.
We just officially met about a week ago, but we realized that we had about a million people in common, had a great conversation at Moku Moku.
And then you're like, we need to have you on the show.
I did, yes. Yeah. Like, you're an interesting guy. I want to pick your brain.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah.
Leighton, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, I do have a day job to support all my other activities. But I'm a potter and... Potter and lighting designer. And these days, I've been working on my brewing and distilling. So I'm...
A little bit of everything.
Yeah. So,
tell us about the co-op that you're involved in. Is it the Bushwick Co-op?
Bushwick Food Co-op, technically in East Williamsburg. It's on Flushing, in the Loom, just above Knickerbocker. It's a little storefront, so we actually do have a grocery store open to members and non-members.
Mm-hmm. How does that work? Do the members get a discount on the things that are on the shelf?
Yeah. Members, you know, run the store, mm-hmm. do the sourcing, running the store, checkout,
mm-hmm.
and
cleaning, stocking, everything.
All the actual grocery store things. And then they get a discount. 4 hours a month is your basic contribution from members. Mm-hmm. And then non-members can shop, but it's a different price.
Yeah. Just, you know, we try to stay, current on hot topics and what the kids are doing. But you know the show Broad City? Have you seen Broad City?
Oh, I love Broad City.
Yeah, well, they're on their third season. You have to watch Broad City. It's actually really hilarious. But there's an episode where she has to go to the CSA, but she has a day, so she gets her friend to go in instead of her, and she ruins everything. But it's kind of funny. Yeah, they do all the cliches of people involved with CSAs, but. Yeah.
We had our own CSA for a while, mm-hmm. and we have evolved from, we were in Fireproof doing a buying store to start, and that was in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been...
What's a buying store?
Buying club. Club.
So is that when everyone goes in to get, like, they all agree
right.
to go in on a bigger purchase together?
We would all look at the what was available, mm-hmm. and then people would make a commitment to, you know, 2 pounds of tomatoes, mm-hmm. 10 pounds of potatoes. And then at the end, it was once a week, and then tally it up, mm-hmm. buy that stuff, and then distribute it. And we were doing that once a week out of the loom, mm-hmm. I mean, out of the fireproof. Mm-hmm. But they got tired of us, and then we moved on.
Thomas Burr Dodd III? Do you know Burr?
I think I met him.
Yeah. I've known Burr for probably 15 years. He's a giant, blonde, curly-headed man. Hmm. Yes.
I don't know. I'll have to meet him.
So what's your history with, you know, obviously you probably have a rich history with a lot of the farms you're working with, or have you ever, like, worked on, did you ever grow up working on farms, or?
I didn't. Yeah. I'm an inner city boy.
Mm-hmm.
But
where'd you grow up?
Near North Side in 3900 North, 1500 West.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Lane Tech,
yeah,
which is a big high school.
What's 1500 North and West? I don't even know where that is.
Yeah, well, the center line is downtown Chicago.
Oh, Chicago. I didn't know it was Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Inner city Chicago.
Okay, yeah. Awesome.
And I think the co-op has inspired me because I have a garden, mm-hmm. Right here in Bushwick, which I love. Mm-hmm. So that's another interest of mine. And I've got 20-foot by 18-foot plot where I grow tomatoes. And it was a junk pile that I've dug up. And
it's actually a good size.
It is. I get a lot out of that. And, you know, it has spurred me to investigate all the micro or nano farm. I say it's a nano farm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, a good tomato plant, if you baby it and grow it properly, it's enough tomatoes for a family for 1 week, you know. When you know, if it's...
Well, I can go through a lot of tomatoes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess. I guess it's depending on how big your family is.
I mean, you know, if you want to make sauce, it's about 50 tomatoes to make a half-gallon jar.
Oh, wow.
A mason jar is 50.
Yeah, you de-seed them and skin them and all that stuff?
I go pretty rustic, skinning only.
Yeah.
It's coring and skinning.
It's coring and skinning, yeah. I don't mind the seeds. I don't mind the tomato seed.
Rustica.
Yeah.
I put everything in my tomato sauce.
Yeah.
Easy.
So what else are you growing besides tomatoes? Just tomatoes, or?
I have sage, Thai basil, Genovese basil, and hops.
Mm-hmm.
So my hop plants have, there've been some trouble. The birds seem to love them.
Yeah.
So I built cages last year, and I actually did get them to grow.
Yeah.
First year, they don't do much, so I'm really hoping this summer to get some real hop buds and make some beer.
Do you know, I didn't know this, but do you know birds like marijuana? And you know how I found out? I was in Nepal for a few months, and, you know, it'd be in, like, city areas and country areas, and I slowly kept on looking for it, and there's literally marijuana everywhere growing, and it's because, I'm like, how is this possible? Because I was thinking, like, everybody had, like, secret pot farms or something, and it's not even really popular over there, but, you know, it's not, like, for smoking, but it's because the birds, there are places where they grow pot, and, you know, and they make hash out of it or something, and so the birds eat it and then poop the seeds out. And then it's like a weed anyway, so it just grows everywhere.
Hops are a cousin
of brother. Yeah, exactly.
They That's look it. Similar.
And so, so you're gonna, yeah, you're gonna play with the hops, obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, microbrewers and home brewers in the city, and either I'll trade or use them myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it a specific type of hop you're doing, or
Cascade? A nice, good, solid, you know,
classic
American hop.
Yeah.
I love Cascade. It has a lot of that grapefruit tone, kind of citrusy tartness.
Yeah.
Good forward. I mean, I picked it for its, as an amateur farmer.
Where did you find it?
I bought rhizomes. I shipped them in from the Pacific Northwest.
Uh-huh.
The little sticks.
Oh, really?
You're kind of disappointed when you first get it.
It's
a dirty little stick.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well. But they did grow.
Wow. That's great. What else? You said that you're a forager. How much foraging do you do?
Well, not that much in the city, but taught a few classes about it. And, you know, Prospect is great. It really is like upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't forage to get a whole meal out of it,
mm-hmm.
but it's great to identify it in the wild, to maybe take two or three of the wild garlic or the shepherd's purse or something, you know, mm-hmm. but not to actually make a meal.
Yeah. Well, unless you're doing mushrooms, which if you look out on mushrooms, you can find, you know.
Are there edible mushrooms in Prospect?
Oh, yeah. No, 100%. In Hudson Valley and Catskills, tons.
No, but I'm saying in Prospect Park.
Oh,
upstate New York. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, you're
because I'm in the city. I'm living.
Oh, you're talking about Prospect Park.
Prospect Park is a great, it's like a little lab. It is a little chunk of the Hudson Valley.
Wow.
So you can, just do a class there.
Oh, wow. That's really, that's
identifying is the big deal.
Where did you learn about foraging? I mean, being an inner city kid.
growing up poor. Trial and error, finding things in nature and eating them.
Yeah.
No.
I don't think that's how you want to do it.
No, actually, Jackson Lander, who is the locavore deer hunter, and I took a couple of classes from him in deer hunting, locavore deer hunting.
Oh, wow.
He wrote a book. He was a little bit well known. He did publish the book, and he wrote another book called Eating Aliens. But I actually started cooking with him in his classes, mm-hmm. and we went, you know, we did a lot of classroom, but then we went into the forest, and he had a hunter take down a deer for us, mm-hmm. so it was laying there, bloody, in the snow, mm-hmm. still warm, and then we took it down and brought all the parts to the kitchen.
Wow.
And that was really great. Really, really,
right?
Really experienced, good learning experience. And then we formed a connection, and we've done a bunch of foraging. And we did a New York squab foraging as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I've made jokes about it over the years. I've never heard of anybody that actually did that.
We got
rats of the air.
the Swiss newspaper Der Zeit came over and did an article on us, a whole feature on us prepping and catching and then cooking the squab.
Wow.
How was it?
Delicious, absolutely. And I bought a D'Artagnan squab,
uh-huh.
and we did it side by side, identical cooking.
Really?
No question, the New York squab superior. Hmm. Absolutely superior. You know, we were pretty careful about it. We documented it. We took the contents of the stomach. We examined the bird very carefully.
Yeah, what are the things that you have to look out for?
Well, I think
with wild caught
fleas,
worms,
tumors, parasites. It was amazing though that this pigeon.
When you dissect it, if it has any of those things, you just throw it away.
Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking right away it would be funny if, you know, you go to Central Park, grab one.
Yeah.
And for those out there that don't know, squab is actually the same as a pigeon. And it would be funny if, you know, you went back to the same spot where you got it, but then you on the walk over, then you saw all these, you know, pictures. Have you seen my bird? It was, you know, one of those old guys that have the rooftop that flies the pigeons. He's like, that was my prized possession. Have you seen him?
Yeah.
That's the pet I want. Number one.
Where's Frankie?
I want to keep pigeons so bad.
Really? There's a guy over on Vera and White that keeps them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We could do it on the roof of the warehouse. Mm-hmm. Actually, because the thing, you need to provide them with shelter, but you don't cage them. You just, you know, give them a home to come back to, and then they come and go as they please.
Yeah.
But also, they were just an interesting, like, self-reliant, independent kind of pet.
Yeah.
You know who's really into keeping pigeons?
Who?
Mike Tyson.
Oh, is he really? Oh, that's cute.
There was, I don't remember, he, like, wrote a book on, or wrote an article about, like, pigeon management.
Really?
Yeah.
That's the old school Italian man thing.
Yeah,
I actually worked on a National Geographic called The Pigeon Game. And that was in the early 80s, and we went around to all the guys. About 2/3 of them aren't there anymore, but still
in New York.
New York, and they do betting and they
racing.
It's like you send your flock up, and it's actually a contest of you had made a better home. So your flock goes up, their flock goes up, and then you count how many of their birds came to your flock. And then your bet is like, I got 30 of yours, you got 10 of mine, I'm up 20 on you.
Yeah.
$10 a bird.
Wow.
There you go.
Nice. And you get to keep the bird.
Usually not.
No, really. Okay, yeah.
If you're betting and you're giving the money, you get the birds back.
Yeah. I could do that. I think I'm also in the neighborhood for a fig tree, a turkey fig. So maybe I just am an old Italian man at heart. Yeah. Not really sure. I'm trying to do indoor gardening.
Yeah. A fig would be an amazing achievement.
Oh, they say they do well
indoors.
There's
one right on Groton.
True.
No. Indoors. Yeah.
They're... Oh, I was saying they're everywhere in Williamsburg, obviously.
Are they?
Oh, yeah, they're everywhere. All the Italians, yeah. Like in between Graham and Metropolitan, or even between basically Meeker and Grand, and then like west of Bushwick, that whole, you know, where like Fortunato Brothers is, that it used to be all Italian. There's tons of wild fig trees. Like I've had people bring me whole bags. And there's one on Groton right here. Black Mission figs.
Wow.
And they're really good.
It's delicious.
So you've worked in film a lot?
Yeah, I would say that that's how I've made a living these many years in Brooklyn.
So lighting director, so are you also like a gaffer? Or?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I also am a cinematographer. Mm-hmm. So I just use the word lighting director because it's, instead of saying both.
Yeah, yeah. So have you worked mostly on like things like National Geographic, or have you worked on films or commercials or everything?
Everything.
Yeah, everything?
Yeah.
What's going, name drop?
Yeah. I did a week with Raquel, and it took 2 weeks to make a week with Raquel.
Who's Raquel Welsh?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that was really at the beginning of the fitness craze. And we had a...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I forgot. Raquel Welch is like her and Jane Fonda were the forerunners of the whole thing.
She was right at the beginning there. We didn't even know what these things were.
Yeah.
And so I was the gaffer, lighting director on that. And nice. We had a great time. Andre, who was her husband at the time, was the director. And we partied. And we had just a great time.
Party, but you're doing a fitness
video. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Nice. Any films that you shot like out of the country that were interesting that you can think of?
Yeah, it's a good question. Out of the country,
yeah, I don't know.
Did some watch video. We had $1 million pocket watch so we went to Switzerland to interview all of the diamond manufacturers, and they had to come up with 162 identical matching 1-carat diamonds.
Really? Yeah. What was the brand of the watch? It was probably Patek Philippe? No.
Don't remember.
Remember. Yeah. That's really funny.
I was at the Nagano Olympics. That was great.
Oh, wow.
So I was working for CBS at the time, and we would go the year before, because this was the Winter Olympics, so you needed snow. And we went to Nagano, and all of the surrounding builds and the snow monkeys.
That's really crazy. Yeah,
that was a good one.
Actually, have you ever heard of the name Andy Sedaris?
No.
He was, I actually worked for him for like a year. There's actually a documentary about him because he actually, in his later life when he retired, he kind of was the guy that invented Skinemax. He invented the TNA, superhero cop, undercover spy, hot playboy, penthouse girl.
Softcore
Skinemax movies. He was like the forerunner of it. And, but before he retired, that's what he did in his like retirement. But his real job, at one point he had more Emmys than any other living human being. He co-created Monday Night Football. He co-created, Wide World of Sports, and then he was also the main director for all the Olympics for like 30 years.
Okay.
Because I guess the Olympics were just solo on ABC during the 60s and 70s and 80s, early 80s. So he was the guy that was like the director for like 8 different Olympics.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was this crazy little short Greek guy, and he couldn't have been funnier.
And then he went on to innovate the world of softcore porn.
But you know what the funny thing is that he had so many connections in LA and in the world. He was such an icon that the people that he got, he would get the gaffer or the cinematographer, there would be guys that were world renowned that just loved him, and the film, and his film sets were notoriously just fun to be on. So there's like guys that make, you know, their day rates are like, you know, $1,300, you know, dollars a day, that would do it for like 175 a day just to work on his films because they were so much fun. So yeah, I got to live in Shreveport, Louisiana. I got to go to Las Vegas, and
Yeah. You've had the most interesting jobs in the world.
I'm actually on IMDb. I actually had a role in one of the films. Some extra didn't show up, so I actually had a speaking role in it. So, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, not really, but.
Phil, I had no idea. You're a movie star.
I'm a movie star, yeah. Actually, I'll tell you a funny story about him because he's a really funny character. But I guess God rest his soul. I don't even know if his wife is still alive, but, I was actually technically working for his wife, and they had this, like, you know, just crazy fucking, you know, mansion in Beverly Hills. And so I'd go to work there every day. I had my own little office in their house. And so sometimes, you know, his wife would get kind of intense and he would save me. She'd be screaming at somebody or me, and he'd kind of look at me and he's like, oh, I got to run in there and I got to take Phil. And she's like, okay, take him. You know? So he'd let me escape sometimes. But I'd spent so much time with him that he has this game that he told me that he did by himself. And it was called Kill Fabio. So Fabio lived two or three doors down from him. So I was actually with him two different times. One time he was just like out getting his mail or something. Another time he was driving in his Humvee. And so whenever he sees Fabio, he just like, pretended to shoot him. And then Fabio was like, why are you doing that? Like, he was so confused. And then so I did it the second time. I did it like, bah, 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 bah. And he was just like, why do you kill me? You know, just like so confused with his long, beautiful hair and his stupid face.
Like the actual Fabio.
Oh, no. Actual Fabio.
Actual Fabio. The I can't believe it's not better, you know, romance novel cover boy.
Yes.
Like literally the Fabio.
Sure, but I just was thinking it was a guy named Fabio.
Oh, yeah. It's like if I said Prince, you know, it's Fabio. Yeah. Does it even have a last name?
No. Fabio? No.
Yeah. Nope.
He's like Madonna.
I thought you should have said it. Fabio.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Then I would have known.
Fabio, yeah. Yeah,
I have a little story, Alexis. You said that you were involved in heritage turkeys, Yeah, no. if only.
Yeah, squab.
So,
oh yeah.
So I ordered a fresh, overnight delivered turkey, and I was really excited about it. This was 12 years ago, and still at the sort of the forefront of being interested in heritage and free range and fresh turkeys. And I got an email in my box, and she's a small-breasted beauty from the Midwest. And I went, oh shit, you know, this is my personal email. I usually don't get porn in my inbox. It turned out it was actually from the turkey manufacturer, and it was a one-minute video of my turkey running around.
Oh, that's so precious. That's so cool.
I like that.
It was really impressive. I love it because I'm a little bit, I like to see my source of what I'm eating. But I think a lot of people were a little, I did not show that to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to balance mm-hmm. that. There is this interesting curiosity into where it's coming from. But then at a certain point, people don't necessarily want to look it in the eyes and say hello to their turkey. I don't really, figuring out where that line is. Is a bit challenging.
Yeah. On Alaska, the last frontier, they raise their turkeys,
mm-hmm.
and they give them names.
Wow.
They call them Christmas, and they call them Thanksgiving.
Wow. Well, I think I mentioned this story when we were interviewing Clodagh McKenna, but there's an episode of the original Gordon Ramsay show, which is more like almost like reality show about his restaurant stuff. But there's a whole season where the subplot or sub story is he bought a pig. And he was raising it. He has like four kids, and they had it in their backyard. And he was showing it to raise it, and then to eventually the finale of the episode, they're going to kill it. And Gordon Ramsay, Mr. like foie gras fucking meat guy, was actually emotional and had a really because it wasn't only that he was connected with the pig, but he was like connected with the pig through his children now too. So it was like really like kind of this emotional hard thing for him to kill a pig, which is like that's what he does for a living. But it's kind of neat.
We're very separated from the killing act. That's people. If it's in a plastic container, they're okay with it. But if they actually saw it die, they're not okay with it.
It's strange to me the people that are uncomfortable if their meat resembles the animal in any way. Like I know people that just like skinless chicken breasts.
Mm-hmm.
in pieces, and they just the idea of a whole chicken weirds them out because you can see the and like that to me is that's the biggest problem is if you're not comfortable with the meat and like where it's coming from and what it was before it got to you.
Well, that's why I only eat chicken McNuggets from McDonald's because you don't even get you don't even have to see the muscle fiber.
I prefer the dinosaur shaped little
yeah.
TV dinner meals.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk some more with Leighton Edmondson.
Leighton Edmondson.
Today's program is brought to you by Thurman Maple Days. Celebrate flowing of sap in the Adirondacks, self-guiding to seven sites for talks, tours, tastes, and old-fashioned friendliness. Maple syrup lovers unite. How was maple syrup made 100 years ago? What are the current practices? What are sugar shacks? Visit Thurman County and go on the maple syrup tour of a lifetime for three glorious weekends to celebrate the start of spring and the end of cabin fever. ThurmanMapleDays.com has all the information you need. Watch sap being gathered and boiled and see how a certified tree farm makes maximum use of the wood from maple and other trees. Enjoy a whole day of fun activities, demonstrations, sampling, and shopping for delectable goodies, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. each day. Like pancakes? Of course you like pancakes. Pancake breakfast at Valley Road Maple Farm is available each day, beginning at 9 a.m. and running until 1 p.m., so you won't have to miss a minute of tour time. If you can already taste the maple syrup, visit ThurmanMapleDays.com to find out more.
Oh, man. I don't know about you, but I want pancakes now.
Yes, Jack Inslee, I want pancakes.
Welcome back to the Main Course Without Patrick Martins on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. In studio with Leighton Edmondson talking about, you know, everything, killing turkeys and now pancakes and maple syrup. And what did you pull out of your bag just now?
His bag of magic tricks.
It looks like a jar of water.
It does, doesn't it?
Is that rainwater from
Prospect
Park? And it's
accompanied by two really interesting ceramic mug and a ceramic, it's like a thimble, but a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. I guess you would call it a shot glass.
I call it a sake glass.
Yeah.
They're beautiful.
So those are high fire. And those are both from wood kilns.
Mm.
So instead of, your typical electric or gas-fired kiln, mm-hmm. these are kilns fired just with wood.
What temperature do you get it up to?
These are like 2250.
Wow.
Which is called high fire, so that's porcelain or stoneware.
Uh-huh.
And some of the ash from the fire actually lands.
It does.
It's there.
Oh, that's neat.
The original glaze, is from wood ash.
Oh, wow.
And that's how they discovered glaze, because when they discovered pottery and they were doing it in wood-fired kilns,
uh-huh.
the ash would lay on the shoulders of the pots and then melt. And then that's how glaze was kind of discovered.
Oh, that's interesting, man.
A little bit.
So you can melt ash.
It is. It's sodium.
Yeah.
And that is, mix that up with water and that becomes glaze.
That's amazing.
This is a really beautiful glaze that you have on here. It's got like just a little bit of crackling and then some kind of copper metallic tones, which is always nice.
Yeah, that's the iron that's in the glaze melts and then reacts with the rest of the bit. So that's a Shino, an old Chinese glaze.
Wow. Is there any carbon in the glaze that comes out or no?
There's carbon. It's
in everything.
In everything. Yeah. So,
I guess in iron there's some carbon, right? And then if it melts, it would probably turn into ash or no?
Carbon doesn't melt at 2400. Carbon melts at like 36. So that would not actually chemically react. One thing that's happening in glaze and clay is you are getting a chemical reaction,
mm-hmm.
but that's happening. at 2,000 degrees.
2,000 degrees.
At our, you know, current living temperature, they're inert. They don't react.
Mm-hmm.
But they do react at those high temperatures, and that's what happens in a glaze.
Awesome.
You know, I forget the role that carbon plays. It's been so many years since I was really involved with pottery. I used to be heavily involved with pottery, though. Carbon is an important catalyst, at least, you know, with raku firing and anything that requires a reduction environment or an environment that is starved of oxygen.
Right.
Kind of creates, you know, helps create some of those interesting metallics and flashing.
Yeah.
It looks like I love that oil puddle. You know, you have all that metallic, like, kind of flashing in an oil puddle or on iron steel. You know, you, like, hit it with an acetylene torch and you get all that flashing and that metallic.
Mm.
I like rainbows.
Mm. I like unicorns.
And mermaid things. Yeah. That's my aesthetic. What's in the mason jar?
This is something I made. This is something from scratch.
You're so crafty.
It's a little bit interesting. It's about 100 proof, so.
Ooh. It smells.
It's sipping whiskey.
It's not. It doesn't burn your nose.
What is it exactly?
This is malted barley and corn. Yeah, this is just malted barley and corn.
Yeah.
It's kind of a classic recipe.
You can taste the barley.
It's there. You know.
Oh wow.
It comes out a little stronger than that. I mixed it. I actually did mix it down with spring water.
Yeah.
Because 100 is kind of want it to have a bite.
Yeah.
You don't want it to be completely just nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the culture of it wants to be a little bit of a bite, a little bit.
Yeah. So what is it? It's barley?
Corn.
Malted barley.
Malted barley. You know what's so funny is this. If I did a blind taste test, I would say this was a high proof shochu. You know, like the barley shochus that actually tastes more like a barley shochu to me, kind of looked, which is like the distilled. Yeah.
To me, it smells like the malt or the wort stage in beer brewing. Like, you know, that really warm kind of like oatmeal looking mash.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can kind of taste it in a very pleasant way. It almost tastes like a brewery smells.
Yeah.
And it's like kind of warm, caramelized,
actually, that's
malty.
So funny. Actually,
and it's nice. It's not too abrasive.
Actually, when I was 6, 7 years old, I toured the Coors factory when I was 7. And it was took me back like that, like, oh, like, you know, giant brewery, you know, like that, like.
I'm sure you know, but all whiskey starts as beer.
I didn't know.
So you make a beer. And in Scotland, they say they're making the small beer without hops. Typically, I mean, of course, you can do anything, but 99% of your whiskeys are not made with hops. You're making a beer without hops, and you are going for other flavors. And it's sort of in the name, single malt scotch.
Yeah.
That means one field of barley made that particular whiskey. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, our American whiskeys are bourbons, which are 51% corn.
Mm-hmm.
But
is that what makes them? You know, whiskey, bourbon, scotch, it's really, I've always been curious. I just have never learned what makes them different and the processes.
Right.
I do find it interesting, and that does make sense that you would start the same way you would start a beer.
Yeah.
The same ingredients. You know what's also interesting? The single malt whiskey is like the original single origin coffee chocolate.
Yes.
Have they gotten to that point where they're, you know, like, this comes from the McKellen's, you know, field of this variety?
And they talk about the spring, and they talk about the field.
Yeah.
They used to also do their own malting.
Yeah.
But
there's a couple that still do.
Very few.
Well, there's one of the big ones, but I saw it just because they had it on their commercial that they hand-turn them or something. Or
what does that mean, like, to do their own malting? I would imagine that they would buy the crop from someone.
No, because they're single malts means it's a single origin malted barley.
You know, like on Champagne's list, they have their growers list.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's like, we grew these grapes. If there were no grapes this year, we wouldn't make the champagne this year. Kind of growers list kind of thing. Yeah.
Right. So McAllen owns, McAllen is a farmer as well.
Yeah.
And Speyside, all those guys, they're farmers.
My mind is being blown.
And they grow a very, you know, barley actually is, you know, it's horse feed food. But then you take the barley and you send it, or you do it yourself, you malt it. Mm-hmm. And a malt house, either you have your own malt house, but now in Scotland there's a central malt house. So they send out the barley to be malted. Then it comes back. It's mm-hmm. been malted. I.e. sprouted.
So that just means like let it chill in water and then it...
Sprout it.
Yeah.
Sprout it, then stop it with a cook. Then you make your beer from that malted grain.
Yeah.
And then what's the difference that makes it... When is the step that differentiates beer from scotch or whiskey?
That beer that ferments is then distilled in a copper pot still. And that distillate that comes off.
That higher concentrate that, alcohol.
Exactly.
Okay. It all makes sense.
This is kind of totally on topic, but did either of you read...
You're always on
topic. Always on topic. No, did either of you guys read Botany of Desire?
Michael Absolutely. Pollan?
Yeah, but the whole thing with apples in the 1800s, you know, when you see the cowboy movies and they're drinking a beer and a shot, it's not beer and a shot. They're drinking hard cider and Applejack. And then the way you make Applejack is you ferment cider until it becomes beer, basically. And then when you freeze it, you take the ice out and you're left over with Applejack. Ta-da.
It's brilliant. It's
magic.
Yeah.
Very low-tech distilling.
Yeah. The lowest. It's how the cavemen used to do it. The alcoholic cavemen that used to roam the earth drunk.
That's what they say.
Looking for squabs and wild garlic in what is now Prospect Park.
It was a farm.
Looking for wild pot.
we're on a farm right now.
Yeah, man.
It used to be... What's why they came to Broken Land.
Actually, we're literally below the original Grange. You know the Grange?
Mm-hmm. Brooklyn Grange.
Yeah, that's where it was. It used to be right on top of this.
There still is a greenhouse right above our heads. Yeah.
We're literally on top of and under a farm.
Back to the roots.
Yeah, man.
I couldn't be a farmer. I kill everything.
Aww.
I know. I had a basil plant and a rosemary plant last all through the winter, but like just at the end of winter, they finally crapped out.
You know, rosemary, by the way, if anybody ever has a problem with mosquitoes, put rosemary near your windows.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, they hate rosemary. Yeah.
I can do that.
You can do that.
I need to do that.
I love rosemary.
Mosquitoes love me.
Yeah. I love one of my favorite things whenever I cook any like vegetables or meats, I love putting like a whole thing of either rosemary or sage in a big pool of olive oil and that crispiness. I love sage. Like fried sage is like my favorite thing in the world.
I love it too.
Yeah. So what else, man?
Yeah. The rest of Sunday. I got nothing else. You know, talking about rosemary, have you tried the Cesare Casella's new salumi?
Yeah.
That we brought in?
Uh-huh. The one that you liked the best was the one I liked. There was three. I mean, they're all phenomenal, but there was one.
My favorite's the picante. It's the spicy.
Oh, I like that. What's, okay, there's, name the three.
The finocchiella.
Uh-huh.
Picante and
the
dolce.
The dolce. I like the finocchiella.
Yeah, that I think that's so, everyone's, that's everyone's
yeah,
favorite.
It's so good. Oh, let's talk about more about the CSA in your brick and mortar store. What's the name and what's the address?
How do
and all
people
that stuff?
Find you? How do people find the co-op if they're interested in becoming members or checking it out?
BushwickFoodCoop.org. Mm-hmm. It's online, pretty easy to find. It's also on the border of Bushwick and East Williamsburg, mm-hmm. Flushing Avenue, and just above Knickerbocker.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Loom, which is a little micro mall.
Yeah.
A portent of things to come.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been living here for 16 years, and I call this Bushwick. I know that's East Williamsburg, but, you know. Or it's East Williamsburg Industrial Complex. It's just so much easier to just say Bushwick.
Or Williamsburg. I mean, it depends on your point of view.
Exactly,
East Williamsburg Inferiority Complex.
Yeah, exactly. You know where Willoughby and Wilson is, right? Obviously.
Say again?
Willoughby and Wilson.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, three blocks from Ridgewood, Queens, technically. And, but of course, I rented that place in, 99, Hasidic landlord, of course, showed me the place on a Sunday morning. You're like, oh no, this is East Williamsburg. This is really, yeah. And of course, you know, 2 days later I move in, I hear a machine gun. I'm like, oh yeah, I don't think this is Williamsburg. Not that Williamsburg was even so great back then, but it's, so funny.
Right. Just, the details, the Bushwick Food Co-op is a grocery store. You can go in and you can shop. You don't have to be a member. Mm-hmm. So it's great to join and support.
Canned goods and stuff like
fresh
that?
Fresh produce.
Absolutely the best fresh produce.
Uh-huh.
We get 3 deliveries a week, and it evolved from a CSA. Mm-hmm. So we're getting CSA style, but better and more.
Wow.
And ethically, responsibly, sustainably sourced.
It's fucking beautiful, man.
It's awesome. If people want to kind of get more information about you or your pottery, is any of that available? Or just come
by the store.
Come by the
Yeah, well,
the
bushwickfoodcoop.org is a great place to start, for what's going on at the co-op. My social media presence is very old school.
Yeah.
i.e. doesn't exist.
Nice.
And I'm okay with that.
Right, yeah, now. Right? That's awesome.
Great. Well, if anyone wants to talk squab or any of the, or whiskey or home brewing or pottery or food sourcing, find Leighton at the co-op. Otherwise, thank you so much for joining us on the main course. Yeah.
Let's go look at some meats.
Let's go look at meat. Yeah. Happy Sunday, guys.
Thank you. Cheers.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.